these names should change the sign. The New York Mothers, Detroit Murders, and Chicago Mob. Boston Biggest, Texas Swindlers, and the LA Cops. Miami Grubs, New Jersey Dubs, take on the Denver Frogs. Seattle Fads, New Orleans Hoods, Milwaukee Cannibals. San Diego Jarheads, and the Arizona Drowns.
Mascot Mania, Mascot Mania,
Heads explode with Dallas Oz, Wall Street, Washington drives. Home team bands play cop killer when LA comes to town. Pittsburgh polluters, Houston drive-by funkster near the fair. From the Ford, abortion bombers meet the San Francisco queers.
Mascot Mania, Mascot Mania, Mascot Mania, Mascot Mania,
Anywhere you go, it gains the same old thing. Bet your money on the bribes. They always win.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Not Another Sports Show here at WRFU 104.5 FM. And before we get started, like always, Damien, our little disclaimer.
Let's see if I can remember. I'm going to try and wing it. Let's see. WRFU is an open forum for the Urbana-Champaign community. Views expressed are those of the speakers and are not intended to reflect the views of WRFU, UCIMC, or the Urbana Socialist Forum.
Again, this is Not Another Sports Show, your weekly progressive look at the world of sports here on WRFU. With me in studio today is the misspelled sign to my dangerously fascistic tea partier, Damien Matthew. I was going to go with the growing increasingly Hitler with lipstick to my Sarah Palin, but, you know, that didn't really pan out.
Oh well.
A lot of news stories this week, and in studio, the IMC's internet is down, so we're having to share a laptop. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But Damien, we had a lot of news coming straight out of your old alma mater.
Yeah, that's right. The it was the North Dakota Supreme Court, I believe, ruled that the University of North Dakota had to get rid of the Fighting Sioux mascot. So this was a really long struggle, and just another one of those, racial caricatures that have been used for athletic mascots. That, you know, one more down. But it was like the typical story. You know, we have alumni for some reason are just seem to be so opposed to any sort of change, any sort of progressive change on this matter. They like having that racist mascot for some reason. I mean, not me in particular, and I don't really understand the argument in favor of it. My most pleasant memories of college had nothing to do with a caricature of a Native American.
Well, you know, in high school, I was always, you know, thinking about the idea of just putting on a giant sheet and going around as the school spirit.
Ooh. Nice.
You know, and so another Native mascot bites the dust.
That's right.
We had the chief here, bit the dust finally.
Mm-hmm.
And thank whatever deity you worship, or, you know, sweet chemical chance if you're an atheist.
That's right.
That it got released. But, you know.
Well, it's still going to stick around, though, right? I mean, I still see chief t-shirts and things like that, so it's just that, you know, officially the university won't be using that the Sioux head logo anymore.
Yeah, but you know, you still see like Rat and 38 Special t-shirts and stuff.
That's
does
true.
It doesn't mean that those 80s bands are incredibly popular anymore.
You know, that's a good point. And you know, it's been like what, 140 some odd years since the Confederate States of America were destroyed, and I still every now and then see a Confederate flag. So,
and speaking of that, Confederate History Month in Virginia.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I didn't. Apparently, the governor forgot something in his Confederate History Month proclamation.
What was that?
He forgot that little thing, you know, that wasn't really a major cause of the Civil War. You know, slavery. Yeah, that somehow didn't cross his mind to put into his Confederate History Day proclamation.
Yeah. Revisionist history. You know, seriously. I mean, I don't even know what to make.
Um, In previous weeks, we talked about the potential expansion of the NCAA men's basketball tournament, also known as March Madness, from 64 teams to 96 teams. We've also covered the abysmal graduation rates of some of these basketball programs. One of the myriad fears about this tournament expansion would be a negative impact on academics for these student athletes. Nebraska law professor Josephine Petuto, who is also president of the Division 1A Faculty Athletic Representatives, had the following to say, quote, "The tournament already has, I think, a substantial impact on the academic performance of men's student athletes. If this is going to have a predictable greater impact, I absolutely think it should be a deal breaker." In a subsequent quote, "It isn't simply the number of classes missed. It's the part of the semester that you're going to have the consecutive classes missed. Think about when you were in school. If you miss a class in January, one class, and you go back the next day, it's easy to pick up the work. That's different than missing four classes in April. You may miss an entire study unit. It's also harder to get back into the process of being in class when you're gone that much." Close quote. Meanwhile, NCAA spokespeople are claiming that the impact on academics will be, as they said, quote, minimal. Petuto's organization executive committee will sit down with the NCAA senior vice president and tournament supervisor, Greg Shaheen, April 23rd and 24th in Indianapolis. And a final call on tournament extension ultimately lies with the board, comprised of universities, presidents, and chancellors. But while there's all these discussions looming about tournament expansion, there's also another discussion looming within the NCAA. And that's renegotiating the TV deal that's signed with CBS that's currently valued at $6 billion. If renegotiated with a larger pool of teams, the NCAA could stand to make substantially more money.
Wow. I mean, that's more than some country's gross domestic product.
Yeah.
Jeez.
You know, and if
that's
if we're going to keep these kids out of class and we're going to add, you know, more schools to this, let's just get rid of that farce that is the quote-unquote student-athlete then for some of these kids. Because they're not.
Yeah.
At that point. They're free labor for a school to get them more notoriety and more money. And on a sad note on this show, Duke won the National Basketball Championship. I know. It was one of those sad things.
Those pretentious little...
Hey, there was that bogus charge call. One of the Butler players was going to the hoop. John Shire jumps in front of him and gets knocked over like the little punk that he is. He deserved to get knocked over. Again, go back and make sure you've listened to our disclaimer.
That's right.
That said, John Shire is a little punk.
You're safe.
And the refs, for some reason, called it a charge. And failed to give Butler the basket and gave the ball back to Duke.
Yeah.
And that was ultimately the deciding factor in the game. And in the aftermath, going up to that game, I found an article by David Sirota called "Does America Hate Duke Basketball Because We Hate Privilege?" And
that sounds interesting.
he makes this following thesis, that we hate Duke, we hate the New York Yankees, we hate those teams that are always on the top, like the Cowboys and stuff, because of our tradition of anti-royalism and wanting to take, you know, the very wealthy elites down a couple of pegs.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
says
I can
that,
see that
very deep down, we actually admire them and want to be them.
No. Oh. I don't know if that's the case. He had me for a moment.
You know what?
But, I mean, there is something in American culture that's sort of, you know, roots for the underdog, right? I mean, you like the Cinderella story, you know? That's one of those classic themes in sports, right? I mean, you want to see something like that. It's heartwarming or whatever.
Yes.
So there's that. I don't know if you want to actually see the underdog become, you know, the dominating force or something. You just like to see him pull out a win.
Right. You know, as I was telling people, you know, Duke beating Butler was like the Russians beating the U.S. in 1980 Olympic ice hockey. It was like the Nazis winning World War II.
Yeah, right. It's so anticlimactic, right?
It's like,
oh, come on.
It's Luke, not Luke and Han, not blowing up the Death Star in Star Wars.
No, I know.
You know, it's one of those sad things, and you know, and
it's like, this isn't how it's supposed to end.
And Coach Krzyzewski actually won a second award.
Uh-huh.
He also won the national championship in being NCAA basketball coach whose last name could double as an eye chart. I mean, nice. I've looked at that guy's name so many times, and it's like K-R-Z-Y-K-X. I still don't know how they get Krzyzewski out of that.
It's like alphabet soup in there, right?
Oh, exactly. Just cover up one eye. K-R-X. But on the bright
side... Is
there
an ampersand in there? What the...
apostrophe Q-P-X. Somehow his team, though, does have a 93% graduation rate.
Oh, that's impressive.
And that's because you don't have a lot of fairly privileged athletes coming from, you know, very wealthy families going into a school that's in one of the poorest areas of North Carolina.
Sure, yeah.
And, you know, Elton Brand had an amazing quote years before when he had played there, and he decided to leave Duke early to go to the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And when fans were pretty much pooping all over him for not staying and helping the Duke evil empire, he had said the following.
Uh-huh.
Quote, "Thank you very much for reminding me of the reason why I left Duke. People like you cannot and will not ever understand my situation. I'm sure Daddy worked very hard to send your rich self to college. While real people struggle, I would like to extend an invitation for you to not waste your or my time ever again.
Wow.
Never being considered a part of your posh group of yuppies really hurts me to the heart. Yeah, right, because I don't care about you or your alumni." Close quote.
Dang.
You know, this whole hatred of Duke for me is a bunch of, you know, privileged kids who, you know, they have, like, George Bush syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
They were born on third base, and they think they hit a triple.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not because, you know, they do stuff right.
No, I mean, that just speaks to the broader, you know, American myth, right, that hard work will get you, you can get anything you want as long as you work hard at it, right? Rather, whoever your boss is will get whatever they want as long as you work hard at it.
Exactly. Right? I mean, I know plenty of people that work hard, can't pay their bills.
No, you work hard, you make your boss rich. That's how it works.
Yes. And speaking of people working hard and making others rich, we've got a new story coming out about the Minnesota Vikings, Damian, if you want to do...
Let me have a look. We're sharing the internets here, so
yes.
Let me switch over here.
Yes, these people at this conference seem to be clogging up the tubes
they're using
of the internets.
Yeah, they're using up all the internets. Anyway, new bills are being discussed in the Minnesota legislature to find money to pay for a new stadium for the NFL's Minnesota Vikings. The proposal was to add even more slot machines to a local horse racing track, and eventually profits from this would be enough to pay for the new stadium subsidies. Estimates for a new stadium range as high as $870 million, and Vikings officials say their request for a public subsidy could range from $29 million to $42 million a year over the 30-year life of the bonds needed to build the facility. The team's Metrodome lease expires after the 2011 season, and Vikings officials have said they would not sign a new lease without a deal in place for a new stadium. Democratic leadership in the Minnesota government have said the bill has no support. So, you know, it's a... yeah, seriously, I mean, this is a... well, it's the Vikings, but...
it's the free market!
Yeah,
we need the government to be completely out of private affairs when it comes to economics.
Except when I need money. Yeah.
Except when they're paying for my stadium to get built.
No, it's a... you know, I mean, I can't remember who coined the phrase, you know, socialism for the rich. And I mean, it's not exactly true, but in this case, you can kind of see where they're coming from, right? I mean, no government handouts except for the giant rich corporate entities, right? So, yeah.
there you have it. And that's why when the tea parties come April 15th, I want to come with a sign like, end corporate welfare.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like the typical welfare recipient, just have a white guy in a suit,
yes,
well-dressed.
Chomping on a cigar, right?
Yeah. That's the typical welfare recipient in this country. And I was at an IEA legislative meeting this past week in Effingham.
Okay. Oh, yeah, you were telling me about it.
I had to leave and go to the bathroom, and I made a very, I made a phone call full of four-letter words to my co-host here. I mean,
pretty impressed.
These people brought out of the mothballs the myth of the welfare queen and saying that they couldn't support tax raises for education and to get us out of this budget hole until we got rid of, you know, the people who graft Medicaid, because this woman who he described as loud, obnoxious, yelling and screaming and brought her multiple children. If you can't figure this out yet, that's code
for black.
That's code for black. And then she got her Medicaid card, and she got out of the building and went into her brand new Escalade.
Yeah, whatever.
And there's no way to really disprove that story, but, you know, it was one of the most obnoxious and racist things I've ever... And in the car, in the drive back, some of us were sitting in the car, and we're just like, I don't know how somebody that stupid wasn't run over by a Buick at age 6.
Seriously. You know, I mean, people only need to look at the government's budget to see where all the money's going. I mean, it sounds like an obvious thing to say, but that's all you need to do. And look at the amounts of money that are spent in some of these things. I mean, nearly half of the world's defense spending is done by the United States. I mean, like, that means if you add up all the defense spending of all the other countries in the world, you would equal the amount that our one country spends on its military. That's insane. I mean, one of two things are going on here. I mean, either we're planning to simultaneously go to war with every other country in the world, right? Or we're not getting our money's worth. I mean, either way, something's wrong here, right? I mean, so yeah, I mean, yell about welfare, whatever you want. I'm going on a rant here. I probably ought to bring it back to sports, but
well, you know, I mean, you know, it's just the money, the way that, you know, this money's getting spent, and the owners are, you know, demanding that if they can't get taxpayer money to, you know, fund these stadiums, they'll move them out of town.
Yeah,
like, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf did in the mid-90s when he said he'd move the Sox to Tampa Bay. You have teams all over the place threatening to move their teams out, or like, you know, Baltimore with the Colts. They moved out in the middle of the night to Indianapolis. And you've got a number of these issues that, you know, they're holding people hostage for more public money to build their altars to their own private greed.
No, that's pretty much it. I mean, that's the formula, right? It's, you know, give us this money, meet our demands, or we'll just leave a giant festering scab in your downtown.
Right.
Good luck filling that stadium. Yeah.
In more toxic idiocy.
Yeah, what else do we got?
Aaron Andrews, the ESPN sideline analyst and now star on the show Dancing with the Stars, along with Cincinnati Bengals wideout Chad Ochocinco, has faced increased death threats coming to her. After, you know, she's already had some schlub videotape her changing in a hotel through the peephole.
So what are the death threats about? Why,
They started off, according to the reports, they started off sexual, and now they're getting more and more violent. But not only is she having to deal with death threats, she's got a anti-climate change, right-wing George W. Bush apologist from Canada. And I'm not going to name who this writer is, because obviously this column is just trying to get her more publicity. She's attacking Andrews, saying, quote, "I have no problem with such women exploiting the industry that has so unabashedly exploited them. But it was difficult for serious sports journalists of the female gender, who have to work twice as hard to garner half the respect afforded to male colleagues, to be taken at professional value, competing for FaceTime with bimbos. Andrews, daughter of an investigative TV reporter in Tampa, is no bimbo, though her sideline features are more popcorn than insightful. But this Dancing with the Stars is colossally unwise. She's made a fool out of herself and a sham of her profession. Bush League, Aaron." End quote.
So she's upset about the Dancing with the Stars thing?
Yes.
There's, like, lots of respectable celebs that do that. I mean, I never watched the show, but, I mean, there are some, like, reasonable celebrities that go on and perform in that, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's not like she's like doing a show in Vegas or something. I mean,
you know, and think of all the other ESPNers that have been on that show. I mean, you know, you had like Kenny Mayne on that show. Oh, that doesn't, you know, completely destroy the male version of sports journalism.
Yeah, so I guess Yeah, so it's because she's a woman and going on this? I don't understand what... She's not doing, like, a striptease or anything. She's dancing.
Right, and, you know, to paraphrase that old video...
Leave Aaron alone! Leave Aaron alone! Can't you see? She's just trying to...
You know, I mean, honestly, like, just because you can't get on Dancing with the Stars doesn't mean you should go after the people who can. Go back to defending George Bush torture, you know, and, you know, the fact that he knew that people were innocent and still sent them to Guantanamo anyway. Go defend that and stay out of popular culture and sports, okay? Okay. There might be some glaciers that are about to melt somewhere. You can go read some more climate science.
Yeah.
Now, Damien, we do have a few different stories about one of your favorite topics, and it's not Tim Tebow, but it would be Tiger Woods.
Oh, hey, oh, do we have a story about the Wisconsin Badgers dropping Nike for?
Yes, we do.
Oh, great. Okay, sorry, folks, I don't have the internets. I just wanted to check to make sure we had that in the lineup. Okay, so what's going on with Tiger?
Well, you know, now it's become incredibly popular for everybody to attack Tiger Woods.
Right, yeah.
Led by, you know, attorney Gloria Allred of Destroy Tiger Incorporated. Well, Tiger Woods, back in, like, the late 90s, during an interview, had made mention of a very traumatic experience in his life. His being victimized and the victim of a hate crime in his first day of kindergarten.
Mm-hmm.
As he had said then, I became aware of my racial identity on my first day of school. On my first day of kindergarten, a group of sixth graders tied me to a tree, spray-painted the word, which is a racial epithet they can't say on air now, yeah, on me, and threw rocks at me.
Wow.
This was my first day of school, and the teacher really didn't do much of anything. Now, this story has been in the news fairly, you know, talked about since the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as of 2004, the kindergarten teacher kind of came out and said that Tiger's lying. Well, now, just recently, with all the mistresses coming out and attacking Tiger, Gloria Allred is now taking over as the lawyer for this kindergarten teacher and demanding that Tiger Woods apologize and say that the story is not true.
Okay.
Now, here's the thing. Tiger Woods has marketed himself as a brand,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's the post-racial brand. He's the Kellen Blazion, as they were calling him.
Okay.
That, you know, he specifically stays away from race-divisive issues and takes a very apolitical stance on most things because that's his brand.
Sure, yeah.
That would throw... This story would throw an entire wrench in the works, you know, if he really publicized and said, I was a victim of a hate crime because I was black.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he'd actually have to take a stand against, there's no way to avoid it. He'd have to make a political statement on race.
Yeah, and you know, right. And why bring that up if it didn't happen?
He doesn't even want to play it up. Yeah, he's not looking for sympathy or anything. It's crazy.
Yes, you know, we had this kindergarten teacher is just one of the other people that's, you know, finding it popular to, you know, get on top and, you know, make fun of Tiger Woods and try to just smash him back into, you know, knowing his place.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, speaking of people who are also doing that, Billy Payne, the Grand Wizard, the chairman of the Augusta National Golf Club. Sorry, I get those confused a little bit. Had some comments about Tiger this past week, saying, quote, as he now says himself, he forgot in the process to remember that with all the fame and fortune comes responsibility, not invisibility. And it's simply the degree of his conduct that's so egregious here. And in the fact that he disappointed all of us, and more importantly, our kids and our grandkids, our hero did not live up to the expectations of the role model we saw for our children. Is there a way forward? I hope yes. I think yes. But certainly, his future will never again be measured only by his performance against par, but measured by the sincerity of his efforts to change. I hope he now realizes that every kid he passes on the course wants his swing, but would settle for his smile. I hope he can come to understand that life's greatest rewards are reserved for those who bring joy to the lives of other people. We at Augusta hope and pray that our champion will begin his new life here in a positive, hopeful, and constructive manner, but this time with a significant difference from the past. This year will not just be for him, but for all of us who believe in second chances. Now, it's really, really interesting to me to hear about moralizing from a man that heads up an organization that has banned women and, you know, was that star beacon of the civil rights movement by letting its first black player actually play on the course or be at the building more than a chef or a custodian in 1990.
Yeah. That's messed up.
As Woods' friend and fellow athlete, Charles Barkley, weighed in, quote, And then you have this punk-ass Billy Payne that goes on TV yesterday. First of all, he ain't told his kids and grandkids to be like Tiger Woods. Let's not kid ourselves. He ain't telling his kids and grandkids to be like Tiger Woods. For them to get on there and act like he's all Uncle Tom, the master of the plantation, that pissed me off. I wish somebody would just walk up to him and punch him in the face.
Nice.
Tiger's my brother, and I love him. I only had two problems with Tiger in this whole thing. Number one, I told him years ago to quit saying you're not black, because all these people who smile at your face, when you screw up, you're going to be black. And that's come back to bite him. We kept telling him not to say that. These people are not your friends.
Mm-hmm.
And as one of my friends noted, you know, when I'm watching this and watching this elderly black man tell, or this elderly white man tell a black man on how to live and how to make appropriate lifestyle choices,
mm-hmm.
Is the title of this golf event really the Masters or the Masses?
Ouch.
Just
ouch.
You.
That's bad.
Yeah. And if you haven't seen it yet, were you able to view the new Nike commercial for Tiger Woods?
You know, I saw part of it. I didn't see the whole thing. I was, like, in and out of the room at the time. But, yeah. It's...
For those of you who haven't seen it, it's a 30-second commercial in black and white with Tiger Woods kind of staring into the screen. And the disembodied voice of his father is questioning Woods' judgment on issues and asking if he's really learned anything from it. Followed by Nike logo.
The heck? God, Nike.
Oh, and I think the interwebs are now up for you, Damien.
Oh, okay, cool.
And you know, it's just like, really? You're going to use all of this horrific events that have happened that have caused you so much pain and so much trauma and caused the mass media to have to, you know, be filled with so much stuff and so much garbage and intellectual bile. You're going to take all of that traumatic event, and you're going to use it to hawk more Nike gear.
Now, doesn't make any sense.
I got no problem with them using the disembodied voice of his father in the ad, because if his father was alive, his father would probably be for that, like, 400%. But really, like, you know, we thought you were a human being, and you're going to use this opportunity where you could talk about stuff and actually be substantive to sell us more Nike crap.
Of course.
Now, yeah. Speaking of Nike, Damien, you had a
a
news story from another one of your alma maters.
Yeah, that's right. So I got my master's degree from the University of Wisconsin, and recently they had ruled to stop using Nike as a supplier for their athletic wear and their there are other, university associated, I guess, clothing. And the reason is because of the sweatshops. Nike uses, this is something that Coca-Cola does and other, you know, multinational companies. They contract out with other companies to actually, do work overseas for them, right? So Nike has third-party contractors in, I believe this was Honduras,
mm-hmm.
right, that were providing T-shirts and sweatshirts and things like that with the University of Wisconsin Badgers logo on it, on license from the University of Wisconsin. And these facilities were actually sweatshops. I believe they had child labor. Everyone, of course, was tragically underpaid. And there was a huge push by student activist groups in Wisconsin to force the university to actually comply with its own standards for ethical labor. And the catch was that Nike claimed that they actually were all of their employees were ethically hired and well paid and everything. It was just these contractors, and they had no control over the Honduran contractors. Well. They finally made a ruling in Wisconsin, and it's a company is responsible for the labor practices throughout its supply chain, which is the way it should be. I mean, basically, Nike was just hiding behind this little technicality to get away with exploiting really cheap labor. So, well done, Wisconsin, and well done those student activists too. That was a hard fight, and they they managed to pull it off.
From well done to not so well done, a district attorney in Georgia is planning to announce whether charges will be brought in the case of sexual assault against Pittsburgh Steelers quarterback Ben Roethlisberger.
That's right.
Roethlisberger is alleged to have sexually assaulted a 20-year-old college student in the bathroom of a club. Sources have told ESPN and USA Today on Friday afternoon that Roethlisberger will not be charged.
Wow. And they didn't even need to interview him or anything in order to come to that decision, huh?
Right.
Wow.
But on to a little bit of more happy news. Eri Yoshida, an 18-year-old knuckleball pitcher who played pro ball in Japan last year, has signed with the minor league club, the Chico Outlaws of the Golden Baseball League. She said, quote, "I'm grateful for this opportunity to pitch for the Chico Outlaws. This is a dream come true for me, and I hope I can contribute to the team and help them win and also continue to improve as a pro baseball player." Now, being a woman and the first one to pitch for in the United States for a professional team since Ela Borders retired more than 10 years ago, she will receive her own hotel room on travel games and her own locker room facilities, but everything else will be totally equalized. And she did teach herself how to pitch a knuckleball watching video of Boston Red Sox pitcher Tim Wakefield.
Nice.
And then he actually brought her to the spring training club and gave her more pointers just recently about how to throw the knuckleball.
Pretty cool.
Major League Baseball players have also threatened to file a collusion grievance, charging owners with conspiring against free agents last winter, saying, "We have concerns about the operation of the post-2009 free agent market. We've been investigating that market. Our investigation is far along, but not yet complete." Apparently, free agents were seeing multiple teams giving nearly the exact same offer to the same player, which had raised some red flags. And, of course, the owners are denying any kind of collusion accusations.
Busted.
Yeah, just a little bit. Now, speaking of these poor owners, some of the parity and pay disparities in baseball. Milwaukee Brewers owner Mark Adanasio has been complaining that payroll disparities in Major League Baseball. The Brewers are in negotiations to sign first baseman Prince Fielder and are experiencing difficulty. In a USA Today interview, he said, "We're struggling to sign Fielder, and the Yankees infield is making more than our team. The Yankees infield will make $85.225 million this year."
Dang.
Yankees president Randy Levine fired back, "I'm sorry that my friend Mark continues to whine about his running the Brewers. We play by all the rules, and there doesn't seem to be any complaints when teams such as the Brewers receive hundreds of millions of dollars that they get from us in revenue sharing in the last few years. Take some of that money that you got from us and use that to sign your players. The question that should be asked, where's the hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue sharing gone?"
Hmm.
Yeah. I find it kind of funny, though, you know, like, the entire Milwaukee Brewers team makes a little over $80 million.
Uh-huh.
And the infield for the Yankees
makes that much.
And meanwhile, while one of the great sports writers, Robert Lipsight, had a fantastic piece that you can find about the opening baseball season called "Root, Root, Root for the Owners."
Okay.
In it, he goes into detail about the steroid era and how it links the war on drugs together with the steroid era. Like we've talked about on this show previously, that punishment became an individual issue, but distribution and use was a team and franchise issue.
Hmm.
Lipsight expands saying, quote, "Drug use was always the symptom, never the disease. You have to start, surprise, surprise, with the post-Age of Reagan disparity of wealth. Greedhead owners get taxpayers to build them new stadiums with luxury boxes in which they can romance politicians and clients and get even richer. The poor schnooks are priced out of those stadiums. No wonder they're having tea parties, being unable, after all, to afford ballpark beer." What if fans and or players own teams? What if they were to start a new league? On to immigration reform. Like the day laborers waiting to be plucked off suburban street corners, teenagers in the Dominican Republic line up at Major League-run academies where they're schooled and tested in hitting, fielding, and throwing. Most will be discarded. The best will be counseled by buscones. Those are the sometimes shady street agents who keep big league hands clean as they rip off big chunks of signing bonuses and doctor papers to make prospects seem younger.
Mm-hmm.
It's time to begin to police this to cut down on the exploitation of the kids. Kids? Yes, the kids. The little leaguers whose characters are supposedly formed emulating their big league role models. Mm-hmm. Isn't this all about them? It's why we need to come back to drugs, so conveniently blamed on rogue players trying to trick Mother Nature. Ignored, of course, has been the tacit encouragement of the management. Don't ask, don't tell, just use. Can we also penalize owners and teams for drug use rather than simply suspending players for periods during which the owners don't even have to pay them?
Yeah. No, I mean, I just cannot believe that owners and managers aren't aware of performance-enhancing drug use in their teams. I just refuse to believe that. It's unfathomable. You know, I mean, so long as they don't get caught, it's to their advantage, you know, to have what do they call it? Plausible deniability.
Yeah.
You know.
It's all plausible deniability. They can say, you know, no, we told you not to ingest those.
Wink, wink,
wink. Nudge, nudge. Say no more. Not.
Exactly.
And we'll end the news of the week on a happy note. The Cincinnati Reds announced their second annual civil rights game on May 15th. During a Wednesday morning press conference at the Great American Ballpark, it was revealed that Hall of Famer Willie Mays, tennis legend and women's sports pioneer Billie Jean King, and entertainer Harry Belafonte will receive this year's MLB Beacon Awards. Former UN Ambassador and Congressman Andrew Young will deliver the keynote address at the luncheon at the Duke Energy Center. Singers Lena Horne and Rachel Robinson, the widow of Jackie Robinson, will also be honored at the luncheon. There will also be a special tribute to the surviving members of the pivotal 1960s sit-in at a Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, where African Americans were once denied service at a whites-only establishment.
Wow.
So this is the second annual one that they've done. They're starting to make a connection between baseball and the wider civil rights movement, you know, and how it's continuing today, acknowledging the connection between sports and politics.
Mm-hmm. That's
and
cool.
Speaking of the acknowledgement between sports and politics, last week, we had talked a little bit about Lester Rodney and the history of breaking the color line in Major League Baseball. This week, with Jackie Robinson Day being on April 15th, we decided to look a little bit more deeply at the history of Jackie Robinson and going into that. And next week, we have it confirmed, we do have a special guest coming in studio, U of I history professor and author of Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line. Dr. Adrian Burgos will be live in studio with us next Saturday.
Excellent.
On the 17th to talk about the history of Latinos in baseball as well as current issues facing Latin players in baseball.
Very cool.
So this is going to be baseball month. So we're going to take a very quick musical break and come back with a look at the deeper, more human history of Jackie Robinson.
By the shores of old Lake Michigan, where the hawk wind blows so cold, an old Cub fan lay dying in his midnight hour, the toll. Round his bed his friends had all gathered. They knew his time was short. And on his head they put this bright blue cap from his all-time favorite sport. Told him it's late, it's getting dark in here, and I know it's time to go. But before I leave the lineup, boys, there's just one thing that I'd like to know. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy-covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue to the home of the brave, the land of the free, and the doormat of the National League. I told his friends, you know the law of averages says anything will happen that can. That's what it says. But the last time the Cubs won a National League pennant was the year we dropped the bomb on Japan. The Cubs made me a criminal, sent me down a wayward path. They stole my youth from me, that's the truth. I'd forsake my teachers to go sit in the bleachers in flagrant truancy. And then one thing led to another. And soon I discovered alcohol, gambling, dope, football, hockey, lacrosse, tennis, but what do you expect? When you raise up a young boy's hopes and then just crush them like so many paper beer cups. Year after year after year. After year after year after year after year after year. So those hopes are just so much popcorn for the pigeons beneath the L tracks to eat. He said, you know, I'll never see Wrigley Field anymore before my eternal rest. So if you have your pencils and your scorecards ready, I'll read you my last request. He said, give me a doubleheader funeral in Wrigley Field on some sunny weekend day, no lights. Have the organ play the national anthem, and then a little na-na-na-na, hey, 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 goodbye. Make six bullpen pitchers carry my coffin, and six groundskeepers clear my path. Have the umpires bark me out at every base in all their holy wrath. It's a beautiful day for a funeral. Hey, Ernie, let's play too. Somebody go get Jack Brickhouse to come back and conduct just one more interview. Have the Cubbies run right out into the middle of the field. Have Keith Moreland drop a routine fly. Give everybody two bags of peanuts and a frosty malt, and I'll be ready to die. Build a big fire on home plate out of your Louisville Slugger baseball bats and toss my coffin in. Let my ashes blow in a beautiful snow from the prevailing 30-mile-an-hour southwest wind. When my last remains go flying over the left field wall, we'll bid the bleacher bums adieu. And I will come to my final resting place out on Waveland Avenue. The dying man's friends told him to cut it out. They said, stop it, that's an awful shame. He whispered, don't cry, we'll meet by and by near the Heavenly Hall of Fame. He said, I've got season's tickets to watch the Angels now. So it's just what I'm gonna do. He said, but you, the living, you're stuck here with the Cubs. So it's me that feels sorry for you. And he said, oh, play that Lonesome Losers tune. That's the one I like the best. Closed his eyes and slipped away. Scotty, it was the dying Cub fans' last request, so here it is. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play in their ivy covered burial ground? When I was a boy, they were my pride and joy, but now they only bring fatigue. The home of the brave, the land of the free and the doormat of the National League.
Okay, and welcome back to Not Another Sports Show, your progressive look at the world of sports here on WRFU. Last week, we had talked a little bit about Lester Rodney, the member of the Communist Party and sports writer that did most of the legwork in getting the popular movement to desegregate baseball going. April 15th is Jackie Robinson Day for Major League Baseball, and I guarantee you will see tons of Jackie Robinson memorials, discussions, players pulling out the number 42 for a game and getting to wear it. And I also guarantee you, Damian, you know, there always seems to be this... what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of, like, static nature of Jackie Robinson. April 14th, 1947, baseball was an equal racist entity.
Yeah, and from that point on, everything's been just fine.
Yeah, you know, it's like...
just peachy.
Like, segregation? Integration? Celebration!
Problem solved.
Yet, you know, race in baseball was and still is a very significant issue.
Yeah.
You know, you've got certain people that only remember Robinson's very voluntary evisceration of social radical Paul Robeson in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Others remember, like the Republican National Committee in October of 2009, tried to claim Jackie Robinson as a, quote, GOP hero due to his lifelong membership in the Republican Party.
Well, I mean, I think, wasn't even Martin Luther King Jr. Registered as Republican briefly? But it was, like, you have to think, I mean, this was, this was a fight against the Dixiecrats. And all of those folks, like, jumped ship and went into the Republican Party after that. It was the opposition to the Jim Crow political structure. Anyway,
right.
Go ahead.
But, you know, all of these prominent depictions do a disservice to the actual human being.
Yeah.
So, with this year's Jackie Robinson Day, it might behoove us to take a little bit of a reflection at who Jackie actually was. Because, you know, he's not some static, you know, left-wing social radical because he helped to desegregate Major League Baseball. Nor was he a GOP hero. Robinson was born in Georgia in 1919. And very quickly, his family moved to Pasadena, California, after his father, who was a sharecropper on a post-war plantation, had asked for a raise, taken the money, and then deserted with a neighbor's wife, and left Jackie's mom and Jackie and his four brothers and sisters in rural Georgia with no real possibility of making a whole lot of money. So his mother very quickly moved the family to Pasadena, California, where her brother was at. And they lived in incredible poverty. You know, he talks about sometimes eating one to two meals a day, and sometimes the only food that they had gotten as a family was the stuff that their mother had brought home from working some of her odd service jobs for other families. Yet one of the things they actually had a lot of success with was the opportunities in sports. Jackie's brother Mac had won a silver medal in 1936 at the Berlin Olympics, coming in second only to Jesse Owens in track. Yet when he got back to California, the only job that he could find was sweeping the streets. And to kind of, you know, protest this, because he had a whole lot of dignity, he swept the streets wearing his Olympic jacket, which caused frequent police outbursts, and frequently the police had to come because local whites said he was provoking them.
That's awesome.
Jackie had earned sports scholarships in football and baseball to UCLA, and unbeknownst to most people, Jackie was actually a very open opponent to racial discrimination. He was frequently getting into arguments with racist fans, getting into confrontations with police officers that were hassling African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And he was constantly, you know, in their faces, debating them, arguing with them, and really not taking any of this kind of stuff lying down.
Mm-hmm.
Which is completely flying in the face of the popular myth of Jackie Robinson that, you know, people yelled all sorts of racial epithets and he was as calm as a Hindu cow, taking it all. That was the right way to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, after graduating at UCLA, he ended up going into the Army in early 1942. And he was court-martialed, right, Damien? Why don't you tell us the first time he was court-martialed and what that was for?
Well, let's see. I have that he was court-martialed for not giving up his seat. I'm not sure exactly what...
Yes, that was years before Rosa Parks.
Oh, for on a bus seat.
Yes. Yes. He had refused to give up his to move to the back of the bus after being ordered by the bus driver to move to the back of the bus, and he refused.
Wow.
And when his commanding officer refused to charge him, they moved him to another unit where the commanding officer would charge him, along with an assortment of other crimes, including public drunkenness. The only problem with that charge? Jackie never drank. And he was ultimately found innocent of all the charges. There was also an issue where he almost faced a second court-martial. A white officer was berating a black pirate, a black private, there we go, and had called him a, quote, N-word SOB. Yeah, but use your imagination, he actually said all of it. Jackie walked up and told the officer that he shouldn't speak to a person in those terms. The officer responded to Jackie with, oh, F you too, N-word, and Jackie nearly killed the guy. Well, in November of 1944, he's let out of the army and really starts, you know, toiling for the Negro Leagues, for the Monarchs, and gets very, very frustrated very, very quickly with all of the travel and all of the problems of not being able to eat in whites-only lunch areas and stuff, and just all these kind of huge problems, not being able to stay in certain hotels, and wondering, you know, what's it all going to be for? And he was really contemplating quitting baseball. And in early 1945, he gets a tryout with the Boston Red Sox, mainly because the management didn't want a very powerful pro-integrationist member of the city council upset with them that the management held a tryout. And the tryout had ended quite ignominiously when the management had started yelling out racial jeers and then said to get the N-words off the field.
Wow.
And, you know, we also had, as we talked about last week, Damien, Kennesaw Mountain Landis preventing the integration of baseball for decades, and Lester Rodney's campaign. If you want more information on that, I suggest you just go back and listen to last week's broadcast. But in 1945, Damien, there started to be some movement with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So.
Yeah, the Dodgers general manager, Branch Rickey, targets Robinson as a potential player to break the color line. And this was a decade before Martin Luther King Jr. and nonviolence, the nonviolent civil rights movement. And he was being asked to be nonviolent in the face of overt, you know, racial oppression. You know, coming onto the team. And in 1947, he was brought up to the Dodgers squad, was spiked, thrown at, and even some teammates started to petition to kick him off the team.
Yes.
You know, this is his own people.
Yeah, there was, that was a lot of that kind of sentiment. You know, even in the minor leagues, he played with a coach in the minors that was a Mississippi Klansman.
Oh, boy.
And at the very beginning, you know, he's like, I knew he was a member of the Klan. He didn't really, you know, say anything overtly to me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I knew because he had grown up with it and hadn't known any other way that, you know, if he was going to say something, like he questioned, you know, when Branch Rickey was there one day and Rickey said, you know, you got to run faster. And, you know, he mentioned the word human and the coach said, you really think he's a human?
Whoa.
And, you know, he's like, it wasn't, you know, something where, you know, he purposely was trying to say that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It was just what he had grown up with. And towards the end of his minor league career, before he gets called up in 47, he's like, it was amazing to see this, you know, staunch Mississippi, you know, raised segregationist coming up to me and telling me, you know, it's been a pleasure and you're a fine person.
Wow. Real turnaround.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I mean, it's just amazing, and, you know, and let's not get all over ourselves in Branch Rickey being some, like, you know, wonderful person doing this, you know, ever so greatly. As sports writer Stephen Goldman had said, Rickey's decision to bring Jackie Robinson to the majors was more complicated, but it had an economic impact. A devoutly religious man, Rickey did have strong feelings about the equality of men and the injustice over the color line. In 1904, while coaching the Ohio Wesleyan baseball team, he had seen the effects of Jim Crow firsthand. The team had gone to South Bend, Indiana to play Notre Dame. Ohio Wesleyan's one black player, Charles Thomas, was told he could not stay in the team hotel. Rickey's impassioned argument on his player's behalf earned a compromise. Thomas could share Rickey's room. Rickey remembered Thomas crying in the incident's aftermath, obsessively wringing his hands. Damned skin, Thomas moaned. If I could only rub it off. That scene haunted me for many years, Rickey said later, and I vowed that I would always do whatever I could to see that other Americans did not have to face the bitter humiliation that was heaped upon Charles Thomas. As much as Brooklyn loved its Dodgers, the team didn't make very much money. And in terms of revenue, they still weren't on an even level with the Yankees and the Giants. So Rickey looked around for an edge. The greatest untapped reservoir of raw material in the history of this game is the black race, Ricky said. The Negroes will make us winners for years to come. And for that, I will happily bear being called a bleeding heart and a do-gooder and all that humanitarian rot. So it also did have a bit of a economic impact.
Incentive, sure.
And as you know, Damien had said, they had a petition very early on to try to get him off the team. And to try to stem off some of this brewing controversy, Dodgers manager Leo Durocher weighed in, saying, quote, I don't care if the guy is yellow or black or if he has stripes like an effing zebra. I'm the manager of this team, and I say he plays. What's more, I say he can make all of us rich. And if any of you cannot use the money, I'll see that you're all traded. Now, 1 week after he started playing, Damien, on April 22nd, 1947, there was a very big incident with the Philadelphia Phillies. And what had happened there?
Right. The Phillies and their manager were chanting racial slurs at Robinson, and Robinson said, quote, and I just tried to play ball and ignore the insults, but it was really getting to me. For one wild and crazy moment, I thought, to hell with Mr. Ricky's noble experiment, to hell with the image of the patient black freak I was supposed to create. I could throw down my bat, stride over to that Phillies dugout, grab one of those white sons of blank, and smash his teeth in with my despised black fist. Then I could walk away from it all. Teammates realized that Robinson couldn't fight back, so they grabbed bats and converged towards the Phillies dugout until they stopped their racial taunts. So, fortunately, he had some teammates that were there to back him up.
Yeah, and it's kind of amazing when you realize a lot of these players, like Pee Wee Reese, are black Southern or are white Southerners coming into defense of a black man. And Pee Wee Reese. Quite famously did it a lot of times in Cincinnati. One time, he put his arm around him. You know, when he was when Jackie was facing the brunt of a whole bunch of racist jeers. Once a Klansman suggested that they would shoot Robinson when the Dodgers entered town on the train.
And Reese said that they'll all wear number 42, right? So yeah. They'll have to have a shooting gallery. Right?
And in that year, Jackie had earned Rookie of the Year, and he had actually contemplated taking some time off just because of all the stress that he had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But he had realized that if he did take time off, then people would just think that he was trying to pad his stats and to keep his, you know, keep his batting title possibilities alive by not playing in the games.
Mm-hmm.
And so he only ended up taking one day off and ended up earning Rookie of the Year, even though he probably should have taken the time off to deal with some of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the belief that Robinson had performed his integration the right way, quote-unquote, had made him a powerful depiction for most liberal whites and most even conservative whites on how African Americans should behave in getting civil rights. And to that end, Robinson was asked by the House Un-American Activities Committee at the height of the Red Scare to come and testify to rebut Mr. Robeson that we talked about earlier, Paul Robeson.
Mm-hmm.
Robinson really didn't want to do this, but he had feared the personal repercussions and the repercussions for future athletes if he didn't make a statement. So when Robinson was in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, his statement included the following. Negroes were stirred up a long time before there was a Communist Party, and they'll stay stirred up long after the party has disappeared, unless Jim Crow has disappeared by then as well. The fact that it's a communist who denounces injustice in the courts, police brutality, and lynching when it happens doesn't change the truth of his charges. But when asked about Paul Robeson's statements that blacks would not help to defend the United States against the Soviets, he had said that that sounded kind of silly. And House Un-American Activities Committee used that as cover to criticize and pretty much completely destroy the life of Paul Robeson.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after the fact, what's not widely known is that Robinson had written, "In those days, I had much more faith in the ultimate justice of the American white man than I have today. I would reject such an invitation if it was offered now. I've grown wiser and closer to the painful truths about Americans' destructiveness."
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things that doesn't really get talked about. You know, people talk about how there's this very substantial shift in, you know, lefty civil rights worker and, you know, really big pioneer of the civil rights movement into the 1960s, where he becomes, as Malcolm X called him, the establishment hero.
Right.
Because he helped to demonize Robeson, because of his lifelong support of the Republican Party. Militant black nationalists in the 1960s derided Robinson as the white man black and saw him as subservient to the white establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Yet Robinson was involved in the civil rights movement, he supported the sit-ins and the freedom rides, he fundraised for SNCC, and he was the most requested speaker for the NAACP. And number two, Martin Luther King Jr.
Wow.
During the 1968 Olympic protest that we've talked a little bit about on this program before, Robinson vocally supported the Olympic Project for Human Rights efforts to have black athletes boycott the Mexico City Olympics by stating, "I respect their courage. We need to understand the reason and frustration behind these protests. It was different in my day. Perhaps we lacked courage."
Mm-hmm.
Now, Damien, as you were saying, you know, Robinson's embrace of the Republican Party was understandable because of the Democrats of his era being the party of Jim Crow and Southern racism.
Right.
I mean, he had campaigned for Richard Nixon in 1960. He had also campaigned for Rockefeller against Goldwater in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
But by 1964, Robinson was appalled by what the Republican Party had become when Barry Goldwater won the nomination over Rockefeller. In his autobiography, he described his reaction to that convention in San Francisco as the following. Quote, "That convention was one of the most unforgettable and frightening experiences of my life. The hatred I saw was unique to me because it was hatred directed against a white man. It embodied a revulsion for all he stood for, including his enlightened attitude toward black people. A new breed of Republicans had taken over the GOP. As I watched this steamroller operation in San Francisco, I had a better understanding of how it must have felt to be a Jew in Hitler's Germany."
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I mean, that party had a radical shift. You know, it's amazing.
But... And, you know, and it, so you get into this kind of situation where he's, you know, not a very big lefty radical, but he's also not one of these people that, you know, would sat back and really took things. I mean... You know, by 1949, he's actually given permission by Branch Rickey. Go ahead, argue calls with the umps at this point. You know, if somebody else, you know, throws at you, spike a player back.
Yeah.
You know, he's given these kind of abilities. And, yes, his movement did really, you know, help to spark more blacks joining baseball, and he became and was a very significant part of the civil rights movement. And so, you know, he's not really, you know, a really lefty radical, but he's also not, you know, the establishment hero, the white man's black.
Mm-hmm.
And he's definitely not a conservative. I mean, because in 1969, just a mere 3 years before his death, he had said the following: "I wouldn't fly the flag on the 4th of July or any other day. When I see a car with a flag pasted on it, I figure the guy behind the wheel isn't my friend." So on this April 15th of Jackie Robinson Day, let's realize that, you know, he isn't some static thing. He was an actual human being that's much more complex, and we here at Not Another Sports Show kind of wanted to bring out, you know, some of these other issues
mm-hmm.
of his history, because he's not just, you know, the number 42 which got retired. He right. had a lot of issues, and he almost wasn't signed because of his very militant background in the civil rights movement, where he was, you know, confronting police officers and had a temper. And that never gets talked about. You know, it was just the calm, he did things the right way
mm-hmm.
that always gets talked about. So we did want to bring that up. And like as we said, you know, this isn't some segregation, integration, celebration! It's a process, and it's still a process that's going on of dealing with racial and ethnic justice in this country, especially in the field of sports. And so next week, we are going to have Dr. Adrian Burgos, of the author of Playing America's Game, Baseball, Latinos, and the Color Line, on the show with us. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that, focusing on Latinos and other ball players. So we've run a little over. You're listening to WRFU 104.5 LPFM. You're Not Another Sports Show is going to conclude for this week. Next week, we'll be back with Dr. Adrian Burgos for interview, your news of the week. And have a good week and a ever so fun Jackie Robinson Day. Tell people the truth a little bit about the complex figure that is Robinson.
Catch y'all later, folks.